It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
Previously on Fox News Rewind, financial crisis, 08.
I personally have been buying stocks since the crash set in on Tuesday. And I have been urging everybody else who can do so to buy without going into debt.
I can tell you this, that we have done many things which have helped the situation.
This Social Security measure gives at least some protection to 30 millions of our citizens.
Economic conditions in the country are good. There are 61 million people on the job.
President Eisenhower, in a good-natured question and answer exchange, says the way to recover economic health is to buy intelligently.
The time has come for a new economic policy for the United States.
It's not my intention to do away with government. It is rather to make it work. Work with us, not over us.
This Christmas, credit card purchases rose at a record rate.
You start to see the froth, the excess, and the outrageous spending, and everybody thinks it's always going to last forever. And guess what? It never does.
I'm Guy Benson. Join me weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and guests. Listen live on the Fox News app or get the free podcast at GuyBensonShow.com.
Episode 2, Foreclosure.
Thank you and good afternoon. I thank you all for coming to the formal ratification of a truly historic event. Senator Graham and Senator Sarbanes have actually agreed on an important issue.
During the Clinton administration, the Secretary of Housing and Urban Development incentivized banks to make loans in credit-deprived areas, essentially suggesting that the banking industry was discriminating against people from lower-income areas of the country.
Co-anchor of America Reports on the Fox News Channel, Sandra Smith.
Banks were essentially rewarded for making higher-risk loans. New HUD regulations then lowered the standards for down payments on a new home from the traditional 20% to 3% and eventually nothing.
Over the past 7 years, we've tried to modernize the economy, and today what we're doing is modernizing the financial services industry, tearing down these antiquated walls and granting banks significant new authority. This will, first of all, save consumers billions of dollars a year through enhanced competition. It will also protect the rights of consumers. It will guarantee that our financial system will continue to meet the needs of underserved communities, something that the Vice President and I tried to do through the empowerment zones, the enterprise communities, the community development financial institutions, but something which has been largely done through the private sector and honoring the Community Reinvestment Act.
When the Clinton administration came in, there had been this sort of desire to make housing affordability across America as a prime component of politics.
Senior advisor to Morgan Stanley Wealth Management, Gary Kaminsky.
In the sense that we should do whatever we can, utilizing government agencies like Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac to expand home ownership.
We're here today to repeal Glass-Steagall because we have learned that government is not the answer. We have learned that freedom and competition are the answer.
This legislation seeks to provide a statutory framework. It wasn't a question whether these affiliations were going to happen. They were taking place, but we needed to have an overarching framework, a responsible statutory framework within which the regulators could operate. We've given them sufficient authority. There's a big challenge in this bill for the regulators, and I see many of them in this room, so we're passing the baton over, as it were, to you as we move ahead now and make the changes in our financial services industry.
I think the major change that went on in the 1990s as it related to housing included two things.
Former CEO of Washington Mutual, Kerry Killinger.
One is the federal government clearly put out a mandate to expand home ownership. And over various presidents, they set goals of increasing home ownership by millions of people.
I am here today because we are taking action to bring many thousands of Americans closer to owning a home. Our government is supporting home ownership because it is good for America. It is good for our families. It is good for our economy. One of the biggest hurdles to home ownership is getting money for a down payment. This administration has recognized that. And so today I'm honored to be here to sign a law that will help many low-income buyers to overcome that hurdle and to achieve an important part of the American dream.
The second is we saw a rising influence of loans being sold to Wall Street for securitizations and loans sold to Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac for their securitizations with a government guarantee on them. And what happened is step by step, banks moved away from making loans for their portfolio and frankly changed their underwriting standards away from what banks typically did to underwriting requirements set by the purchasers, which were Wall Street and and Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac.
There were a number of changes in the 1990s that affected the housing market.
Former member of the Federal Reserve Board of Directors, Randall Krosner.
One of the most important pieces was the development of the government-sponsored enterprises, the GSEs, they're sometimes called. And there were two particular names, Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae, of these organizations. And what they did is they provided guarantees for mortgages. So, of course, that made it cheaper to borrow. In addition, what they did is something called securitization. And so what that allowed for is whoever was originating the mortgage, whether it's a bank or a broker, what they could do is then sell them off into these packages. And so you'd have 100 loans or 1,000 loans in a particular package. And if you got them from around the country, you could get a reasonably well-diversified set of loans. And there were a lot of people who were eager to invest in that.
What we're trying to do here is to take a number of steps at once that will bridge the gap between where people currently are and getting into a home ownership situation, which is one they can afford and one they can sustain. We have no interest whatsoever in putting people into houses or into rental units that they can't afford or that they can't maintain the payments on.
Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae are special government-sponsored enterprises. So they are corporations, but they're not like regular corporations. Their charters are from the federal government. And they were publicly traded organizations like other private companies on the stock market. But they had, in addition to the profit motive, a public purpose to provide for affordable housing. And so what they were doing is they were providing guarantees for mortgages. They set standards for mortgages. If a mortgage had a certain standard, that is that the family had put enough money down to start with, the family's credit rating was strong enough, that their income was strong enough, Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae would guarantee those mortgages. And they also then helped to move those mortgages off of banks' balance sheets, because traditionally the bank would make the mortgage, hold on to the mortgage, and then eventually the family would pay it off. Now what would happen is the bank would originate the mortgage, Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae would provide the guarantee, and then they could sell that mortgage off into the markets.
Anyone who got in early or already owned a home saw their net worth increase. Flipping houses became a new source of income, and home builders had a hard time keeping up with demand. Mortgage originators and the banks who provided them with the credit all reaped profit from the increased economic activity.
So inflation is low, interest rates are low, the Fed is gradually starting to raise them. And even when the Fed raises them, you know, the Fed manages just a small, a very short-term interest rate, and other interest rates tend to follow the Fed's lead.
Senior writer at the Wall Street Journal, John Hilsenrath.
But even when the Fed started raising interest rates, other rates weren't moving. Mortgage loans, even as the Fed raised rates, mortgage rates stayed really low. And it was part because there was all this demand from overseas, and especially China, to hold U.S. securities. So we had a housing boom. This all fed a housing boom.
And that's where these subprime loans came into play.
Host of Your World on the Fox News Channel and Cavuto, Coast to Coast on the Fox Business Network. Neil Cavuto.
People were buying them because they would take all these risky assets, these risky loans, these mortgage-backed obligations, or these collateralized loan obligations, and they would package them and sell them to others who would buy them, unaware that group of people were buying and companies that were buying those mortgages didn't realize that the mortgages underlying them, some of those people weren't paying them anymore. They were not making payments regularly, or they were just defaulting altogether. The buyers of those securities oftentimes didn't know that. But beneath the surface, when everything was looking just hunky-dory, we were getting a sense that there was trouble in paradise here, that not everyone was making good on those mortgage payments.
By 2006, when there had been some skepticism related to some of the originators of mortgages, some of those that, you know, ultimately were part of responsible companies, if you remember, like Countrywide Credit, for example, you know, I would say as early as 2006, there was a concern that a lot of these mortgages were so low quality and that they were being repackaged and sold that despite the fact home ownership, was at all-time high percentage-wise, there had been concerns as early as, let's call it, late 2006, that the foundation that these were built on were you know, sort of like the picture I think of is like one of these houses on the beach, you know, built on stilts where they have a lot of hurricanes and bad weather.
I did not come to the FDIC until the summer of 2006, and the cat was largely out of the bag by that point.
Former chair of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, Sheila Bair.
And unfortunately, we had our staff at the FDIC had been watching this for a while. They were worried about it. They flagged it as an issue. We immediately started pushing for mortgage lending standards, not just for banks, but for non-banks as well. There was resistance to that. We did get some stronger standards for regulated banks, but for non-banks, the Fed was really the only one who could do that, and they just didn't want to do it. So it wasn't until 2006 when I started looking at that. But yeah, I mean, as soon as I got to the FDIC, I got worried pretty fast. We got busy pretty fast.
You know, anybody who's bought a house now realizes in the past 10 years, it's like they treat you as if you're a criminal.
Host of the Clayman Countdown on Fox Business, Liz Clayman.
How much do you make every day? What are the chances you'll lose your job? Well, back then, nobody asked anything. In fact, there was this thing that was unofficially called the ninja loan. No income, no job. And you still got a loan. But what people didn't realize is that they didn't read the fine print, and those ninja loans or subprime loans would reset at much higher percentages in a couple of years, depending on the term. And suddenly, when all of these loans began resetting, people realized, I can't afford this mortgage. And they did what nobody expected them to do. They walked away from the homes.
Americans used a lot of this cheap credit to buy bigger homes, to get into first homes. In some cases, it helped make people better off. That was the American dream. But in some cases, it was really facilitated people stretching themselves to a place they didn't belong. And these became ingredients for the bust that was looming in 2007.
I am Henry Derrick Paulson, Jr., do solemnly swear that I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States.
Hank Paulson he's a Republican, and he was the chief executive of Goldman Sachs. And he was hired by George W. Bush to run the Treasury. And so he had a lot of experience on Wall Street, and then showed up right as Wall Street was collapsing. So he was in a tricky position.
I appreciate the trust you have placed in me to lead the Treasury Department at a time when we must ensure that our economy remains strong, our markets remain competitive, and our workers have the opportunity to realize their full economic potential.
At the time, obviously, Hank Paulson, a former CEO of Goldman Sachs, was in a role, in a government role as Secretary of the Treasury. And so it's important to remember when the history is written that although his, and he has spoken about this and he has written about this, that he was not acting as a private citizen, former head of Goldman Sachs. He was acting as a fiduciary for the U.S. government. I'm one who believes, having, you know, been in the industry now close to 40 years, you know, it's impossible to separate out things that might have happened in your private life versus your public life.
He was a China expert.
Chief economist at Moody's Analytics, Mark Zandi.
And I think he thought that he'd be spending most of his energies and time on the U.S.-Chinese relationship, but everything got obviously sidetracked.
Late last year, it looked like this housing decline might end sooner than it now appears to be, that this is something that bears watching, and it is, and there's no doubt about it, it is taking a penalty to growth. There's a penalty to growth here, and by virtue of what's going on in the capital markets. So that's the biggest risk. But I continue to believe we're going to continue to grow. And so I'm optimistic about that.
Stocks slowed their slide after U.S. and foreign central banks poured several hundred billion dollars into the financial system to reassure investors they won't be pinched by a credit squeeze. It's the biggest infusion of cash since the 9/11 attacks, and it's tied directly to subprime mortgage defaults, now about 13%, according to some U.S. officials. Europeans are concerned because they bought some of the loans, and their investors are worried because they don't know how many.
It's like a black box, you know, and we don't know what's it inside, and we have any visibility, so we'll have lots of fears.
And when you get uncertainty in stock market, you find they go one way, and that's downward.
A lot of people look at toxic assets as assets that were once very, very popular, but fell on hard times. For example, we were talking about mortgages that look good, whether they were subprime or prime, that fell on hard times. Well, a lot of brokerage houses, investment banks would sell those mortgages, what you might call toxic assets, on the open market, and people would buy them up. Companies would buy them up, repackage them, and sell them to other borrowers and other interested bidders. And it was all great when things were great. But, you know, an uptick in rates or the first dinging that we see of some customers who are not able to pay back those mortgages or pay them on time, that was toxic. Those assets, those collateralized loan obligations, mortgage-backed securities, some of these things you've heard about that people would buy and sell in the open markets, a package of all of this stuff that was essentially financial crap, then began to be an investment that no one wanted to deal with. No one wanted to buy. And all of a sudden, cancer was on the system.
One area that has shown particular strain is the mortgage market, especially what's known as the subprime sector. Unfortunately, there's also been some excesses in the lending industry. One of the most troubling developments has been the increase in adjustable rate mortgages that start out with a very low interest rate and then reset to a higher rate after a few years. This has led some homeowners to take out loans larger than they could afford, based on overly optimistic assumptions about the future performance of the housing market. Others may have been confused by the terms of their loan, or misled by irresponsible lenders. Whatever the reason they chose this kind of mortgage, some borrowers are now unable to make their monthly payments or facing foreclosure.
Washington Mutual took a number of actions over concerns about a potential housing bubble back in the 2007-2008 period. First thing is, beginning in 2003 through 2007, we cut all residential lending by 74%. The second thing we did is we increased the FICO scores, in other words, the quality of the loans, each year from 2003 through 2007. So tightened the underwriting standards. Third thing we did is we eliminated virtually all subprime lending during as that period went on. And finally, we went out and raised $11 billion of additional capital to see us through what looked like it was going to be an increasingly turbulent period. So a number of very aggressive actions that we took with what we thought were growing risks.
We were the first, but I think Hank was the most responsive and attended to our concerns and did start seeing it earlier than some of the folks did at the Fed. And so I think, you know, I always appreciate that. Hank and I didn't always agree on things, but I thought we had an open, transparent relationship and talked and learned from each other. I think we both benefited from that. So, yeah, and Hank, when we started, you know, when we realized all these loans had been made, and there's no going back on that, we were just going to have these massive defaults, then we shifted strategy, and this again was something the FDIC led, to try to get loan servicers to start making systematic loan modifications.
Our economy will continue to grow, but it is facing a number of challenges. And as I've said before, the housing market downturn is the biggest challenge to our economy. When home foreclosures spike, the damage is not limited only to those who lose their homes. Homes in foreclosure can pose costs for whole neighborhoods as crime goes up and property values decline. Avoiding preventable foreclosures, then, is in the interest of all homeowners. Mortgage market financial innovation has benefited the U.S. economy and U.S. homeowners. It has also introduced some of the challenges we are facing today. Financial innovation led to the creation of mortgage products that put homeownership within the reach of more people. At the same time, innovation also made riskier loans with no down payments or minimal documentation and made these loans more widely available. Similarly, securitization has brought benefits and challenges, making more capital available to mortgages but creating greater market complexity. As a result, we now have an array of different market participants, often with different interests.
You know, we said, look, you want to let this mortgage default, go into foreclosure, put more housing stock in the market, drive home prices further. Do you want to do that? Or do you want to try to do a loan workout, at least for the, you know, the owner-occupied? A lot of the subprime was owner-occupied. We want to work with these people living in their house and want to keep it and reduce the payment and see if they can manage the payment, because your losses are going to be a lot less severe taking a reduced payment through a loan modification than just by foreclosing on these homes. So Hank helped us with that. Originally a little resistant, but then helped us with it. I remember I wrote an op-ed in the New York Times, and I believe it was October 2007, calling for systematic loan modifications. Got a lot of pushback, a lot of skepticism, but boy, 6 months later, people were, you know, scrambling to try to get better protocols in place to do this, and the FDIC did lead the way on that as well, and I'm proud of that. But you know, Hank was responsive and gave us public support and instituted a treasury program, because he had a lot farther, you know, further reach and clout than we did at the FDIC, and we were influential, but mainly in our, you know, our regulated banking sphere. Most of our regulated banks were community banks, so it was a constructive relationship, and I appreciate the help you tried to give us on loan modifications.
The great growth of Bear Stearns from 2000 to 2007 was recognizing that they could be a tremendous manufacturing business for a lot of these subprime and less than, you know, quality mortgages. Their clients were there was demand on their client base to buy this type of investment, to buy these papers with the higher interest rates. And there was a belief among many of the clients that the risk, you know, by pooling all these various mortgages, that you were mitigating the risk, because if just basically a handful of them defaulted, that there'd be plenty of good paying mortgages. And so, you know, Bear was the architect behind it. They were the leading bank, both from the issuer standpoint as well as an investment banking creating standpoint. You know, others began to see the amount of profitability in the space and started to also issue a lot of these mortgages. Merrill Lynch was very aggressive at the time, but Lehman Brothers, Goldman Sachs even got into it. And so everybody was basically trying to participate because it was a highly profitable segment of the business.
You have to understand the personality of investment banks. And when you're talking about the big ones, let's say Goldman Sachs was considered what they called the white shoe firm, the classy firm, you know, the Royal Academy, superstar, Tony Award winning bank. And then you get to Bear Stearns. These guys were the gutsy ones. They were slightly smaller, but they played a huge part in the investment banking world in New York. These guys were sort of the sitcom guys with the quick cracks and things like that, but they made a lot of money by taking risks that other banks did not want to take.
You know, Bear Stearns was one of the most successful firms on the planet. It had become sort of like the preeminent concern for those who wanted to finance building in this country and massive infrastructure projects. Bear Stearns would invariably be the money supporting that. It would underwrite and support mall developments, hospital developments, big in county government and state government initiatives. It was the financing that made America move. That was used to be some of the jargon behind it. Good in boom times, not so good when they're not so boom times.
Bear Stearns was founded in 1923. It was an investment bank. And Bear Stearns was the first major sign of a troubled market when in June 2007, it reported a 10% drop in quarterly earnings. It was a major red flag in the crisis.
I got a phone call from a friend.
Host of Making Money on the Fox Business Network, Charles Payne.
And when he told me, you know, the price, it was like, you got to be kidding me. I thought he was joking, honestly. You know, obviously throughout history, there have been some major firms on Wall Street that have come and gone. I worked at a firm called E.F. Hutton in the early 80s, and they were maybe a top five firm, and they actually fell off, and it was kind of hard to believe, but that was sort of a natural, there was a lot of acquisitions, but that was just sort of a natural thing of a company, you know, not keeping up. This Bear Stearns was something else. This was an indictment against the entire industry. It was a shock to the system. And obviously the ramifications, and it wasn't just Wall Street. I mean, obviously if you worked on Wall Street, if you are on Wall Street, you were shocked. But more importantly, it was just like how unstable the system was.
Good afternoon, everybody. As we said in our release, you know, Bear Stearns has been subject to a significant amount of rumor and innuendo over the past week. We attempted to try to provide some facts to the situation, but in the market environment we're in, the rumors intensified, and given the nervousness in the market, a lot of people, it seemed, wanted to act to protect themselves from the possibility of rumors being true and could wait later to see the facts. So although our capital ratios remain in good shape, our liquidity situation deteriorated. We started the week and through the early part of the week, we continued to have very strong liquidity, but the concerns on the part of counterparties, on the part of our customers and lenders, got to the point where a lot of people wanted to get cash out.
We did not have a lot of firsthand knowledge on the inner workings of Bear Stearns. I just didn't do a lot of activities with them. They had exposures to some of these securities that were both highly leveraged and had a higher than normal percent of subprime loans included in many of those securitizations. And when things started to unravel and become very difficult in 2007 and 2008, I think that they were one of the parties that got into a liquidity challenge, and the Fed and the other banking regulators needed to step in and try to help that lack of liquidity that they had.
The Federal Reserve responded by creating new credit facilities for investment banks. Prior to that, the Fed could lend only to commercial banks, but using the emergency powers that were granted in the 1930s after the Great Depression, created these facilities to be able to extend credit to non-bank organizations, for example, in investment banks. And then there was a merger partner with J.P. Morgan Chase, who took over Bear Stearns, helped provide capital, helped provide the support necessary, and so Bear Stearns was stabilized. It was not a disorderly bankruptcy. It was really just sort of taken over.
We were responsibly trying to deal with those needs, and we were meeting those needs in every case. But they accelerated yesterday, especially late in the day. And as we got through the day, we recognized that at the pace things were going, there could be continued liquidity demands that would outstrip our liquidity resources. In light of that, we felt like we needed to move quickly to allow us time to conduct normal operations and calm things down and allow us time to get some more facts out into the marketplace and have people get a chance to assess them. Prior to this period, we had been working with Lazard and Company, looking at some alternatives. In consultation with them, we decided to talk to J.P. Morgan and talk to them about providing a liquidity facility that will allow us to achieve the objective of calming down the marketplace and giving us a chance to get some facts out into the marketplace.
We were not consulted about that. We didn't need to be consulted. We were just, our exposure was virtually nil.
Sheila Bair.
And, we didn't regulate Bear Stearns. It was an investment bank. It wasn't a federally insured regulated depository. So the New York Fed and Treasury, I believe, really worked hand in hand on that. I will tell you my observations as a third party, that I was concerned. I thought this set a bad precedent for the expectation of bailouts. I did not view Bear Stearns as systemic. It was a relatively small investment bank. So why the New York Fed decided to facilitate a sale to J.P. Morgan Chase and provide financial support for that, I did not understand. I to this day still think that they should have let Bear Stearns fail. It was early on. It was before things started getting dicey. It would have, sent a strong signal, I think, to these large financial institutions that they needed to get their act together.
Jamie Dimon had a busy week last week trying to mollify investors in Bear Stearns who were unhappy with the $2 a share takeout. He basically had two problems he ran into. One was not only upset investors, already shareholder lawsuits coming forward last week, but the other thing was keeping top talent at Bear Stearns post-acquisition.
In this particular crisis, we made a lot of mistakes and we made some lessons. And, Warren Buffett says when the tide goes out, you see you swimming naked. And we knew it was subprime mortgages, CDOs, some of the monolines who guaranteed it. And the tide, unfortunately, may still be going out a little bit. And while history may not repeat, it certainly rhymes. So here's the similarities of the crisis, which should never surprise us. Risky assets reprice. Things get volatile. Short-term funding dries up. Certain assets become illiquid, and they become illiquid overnight. I think that's a huge problem we've had this time, too. There's enormous pressure for growth in corporate America and, grow, 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 and then people sometimes do the wrong thing. And I give tons of examples of that. New products have problems. Okay, that was true with almost every financial product we've ever seen that has its own series of problems. And so that goes way back to equities and options and mortgages and this time, obviously, subprime, CDOs, and a whole bunch of others. And we also started this in the most benign credit environment we've ever seen.
So you have to ask yourself the question, well, where did they get the money
to hold these instruments.
John Hilsenrath.
Where does that money come from? So think back to the banks of the Great Depression. They had a very simple model. Mom and pop would deposit their paycheck in the bank. And then the bank would kind of take that money and they would loan it out to the hardware store or to another mom and pop down the street who wanted a mortgage. So mom and pop who deposited were lenders, and they expected to be able to pull their money out of the bank whenever they needed it, you know, if they had to pay bills or something like that. The money was tied up in loans to other people. And what the bank was counting on, that mom and pop didn't all show up at the same time and say, I want my money back today, right? Well, what we had with Bear Stearns was one of the first examples of a modern run on the American financial system.
This is the worst that I've been in the market myself, 46 years, never seen anything like it in all my life. Even the crash in 1987 when the stock market lost 30%, at least we knew it was going in one direction. It was all over in 3 days. Then we saw the Russian credit crisis in 1996. Again, that was a sharp correction, but we came back again. This has been bobbing around like a cork in a bath now for the period of the last 3 months, and it's very unsettling and very unnerving. And it's all caused, as I say, by fear and uncertainty.
Well, it led to a panic.
Economist and Fox News contributor Steve Moore.
Bear Stearns and some of these other big investment banks started to collapse. Then it was just like dominoes falling, and one after another after another, and there was a panic. It was a full-fledged panic.
Government responded under the Bush administration, providing different kinds of fiscal support to the economy, stimulus.
Mark Zandi.
We didn't know it at the time, but the economy had already entered into recession. It began in January of 2008, but it wasn't clearly evident when, you know, Bear went under a few months later. But the Bush administration was concerned about what was going on with the economy, and they cut a deal with the Democratic Congress and passed legislation to provide some support to the economy.
The news this morning regarding Bear Stearns is obviously on everyone's minds. I'm not prepared here this morning to tell you whether or not the action taken by the Fed and other financial institutions is the right or wrong move or not. All I do know is it's a reflection of this deepening problem that we're facing, triggered by, of course, the foreclosure crisis in real estate.
I think the perspective of Treasury was really twofold. One was the idea that Chairman Bernanke suggested, that a combination into safe hands would be constructive for the overall marketplace. And number two, since there were federal funds or the government's money involved, that be taken into account. And Secretary Paulson offered perspective on that. There was a view that the price should not be very high or should be towards the low end, and that it should be, given the government's involvement, that was the perspective. But with regard to the specifics, the actual deal was negotiated, or transaction was negotiated, between the Federal Reserve Bank of New York and the two parties.
President Geithner, do you share any light on this at all, on these rumors that have gone around about federal agencies recommending a lower price rather than one that was being offered?
No, let me just echo what the chairman and Bob Steele said. Two objectives very important for us. One was there'd be an agreement reached that would avert the risk of default because of the consequences for the economy as a whole. And the second was that the outcome, to the extent possible, not add to the inherent moral hazard risk in this kind of intervention. And I just, from my perspective, the outcome reached that evening and the subsequent agreement reached a week later are fully consistent with those two objectives.
One of the reasons capitalism works is because ultimately you have to do right by the end user, the consumer. If not, they'll go somewhere else and get a different product. So if you want to make a car and you want to skimp on the brakes and people know that your car doesn't have good brakes, they won't buy your car. Wall Street has been able to find itself in a position where there's no real alternative per se. And you would think, well, the different firms would say, I'm going to come up with a good stock, you know, or better stock or better research. And yet it feels like when one goes off the rails and is making a lot of money doing it, the rest of them kind of say, look at that. And, you know, and so I've always said, listen, I consider myself the Pied Piper of the market. I've been asking people and encouraging people to invest for 30 years. But I also admit that it's not It's not a fair game, per se. It's not a level playing field. And beyond that, you know, but you have to participate, but never, ever 100% trust Wall Street.
Next time on Fox News Rewind, financial crisis, 08.
Some commercial and investment banks and the government-sponsored enterprises have reported substantial losses and write-downs, reducing the capital they have to support new lending.
There were problems in the summer of 2008 that were bubbling under the surface, serious problems.
While both presidential candidates support the bailout, both suggest it's in the nature of Washington lobbying that the two GSEs got too big to let fail.
If you think you're going to need capital, don't be looking for the government to help you.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network. Subscribe and listen to the Trey Gowdy Podcast. Former federal prosecutor and four-term U.S. congressman from South Carolina brings you a one-of-a-kind podcast. Subscribe and listen now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.